From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
When very few people were paying attention, the American intelligence apparatus in the shadows was handed over to private corporations.
R.J. Hillhouse on the privatization of intelligence and how corporations like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon are running large parts of the nation's intelligence agencies. Then we will be joined by an Iraqi teacher on her first trip to the United States.
Well, the children in Baghdad are suffering. The life is very, very bad. And
we'll speak with the Iraqi teacher Nasreen and a Brooklyn teacher. They and their students have been emailing each other for years. The Brooklyn teacher's nephew died in the 9/11 attacks. And finally, we'll go to Nigeria to speak with UC Berkeley professor Michael Watts. He was just attacked and shot in the Niger Delta. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is facing a possible perjury investigation over his sworn testimony on the Bush administration's domestic spy program. On Wednesday, Senate Judiciary Chair Patrick Leahy said he may request the probe over Gonzalez's insistence that a March 2004 meeting with congressional leaders was not called to address the warrantless spying. Several lawmakers in attendance have denied Gonzalez's account, and newly released documents show then-Director of National Intelligence John Negroponte later described the meeting as, quote, a briefing on the terrorist surveillance program, the same name administration officials used to describe the warrantless spying. Senator Leahy says he will give Gonzalez until next week to revise his testimony, or he'll ask for perjury inquiry. We'll have more on Belcher Gonzalez later in the broadcast. The House Judiciary Committee has voted to hold former White House counsel Harriet Myers and former White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolten in contempt of Congress for refusing to testify in the firing of nine U.S. attorneys. The two White House aides ignored a subpoena after President Bush claimed executive privilege protects them from testifying. The contempt measure will now come before the full House. In Iraq, mass celebration of a national soccer victory turned to tragedy Wednesday after car bombers targeted celebrating crowds in Baghdad. 50 people were killed in separate attacks on thousands of people cheering the Iraqi soccer team's semifinal victory in the Asian Cup. More than 100 people were wounded. In other Iraq news, the House has overwhelmingly approved a measure that would ban permanent U.S. military bases in Iraq and prevent federal spending on controlling Iraq's oil. The measure passed by a vote of 399 to 24. U.S. investigators have found the engineering giant Bechtel National failed on more than half of projects assigned under its $1.8 billion contract in Iraq. The failed efforts include a sewage treatment facility, an electrical plant, and a massive landfill. Bechtel was one of the first U.S. companies to benefit from the post-invasion contracting boom in Iraq. The Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction says State Department officials signed just two staffers to oversee Bechtel's work. In Afghanistan, Taliban kidnappers have killed one of the 22 South Korea church workers held since last week. The Taliban says more will be slain unless the Afghan government releases captured rebel fighters. In Seoul, dozens of people held a candlelight vigil for the hostages. This is vigil attendee Jung Hyung Jong.
The hostages must spend every day in pain. Whenever we think about them, all we have to do is pray for the complete withdrawal of the troops. What else can we do?
In Colombia, an estimated 2,000 indigenous Colombians continue their march to Bogota, calling for talks with the rebel group FARC. The marchers also want rebel groups to release all hostages held in Colombia. This is indigenous Colombian leader Eliseo Ipia.
Day after day, more people from all social levels are coming together and unifying with this cause through this march from Cauca to Bogota, because we are saying yes to life and no to death.
The march comes as Human Rights Watch is accusing FARC of making Colombia the country with the most landmine victims in the world. Human Rights Watch says more than 1,000 people were killed by anti-personnel mines in Colombia last year, up from 300 the year before. In Cuba, eight Americans have become the first class of U.S. graduates from Havana's Latin American School of Medicine. The students are among 2,100 people from 25 countries in the tuition-free six-year program. All eight say they plan to practice medicine with underprivileged communities in the United States. This is graduating student Carmen Landau.
We should take advantage of our position coming from this medical background to try to promote more the possibility of creating a universal health care system, a single payer system in the U.S. I know that California is potentially working towards that. It's a wonderful idea.
More than 100 Americans will be enrolled in Cuba's medical school this fall. The students are allowed to study there under an exception to the U.S. embargo. A presidential commission is calling for a major overhaul in medical care for wounded U.S. soldiers. Chaired by Donna Shalala and former Senator Bob Dole, the group calls for improvements in treating brain injuries, dealing with post-traumatic stress, and revamping the veterans' disability system. The commission was appointed following the Washington Post exposé on poor conditions at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. The Bush administration initially said it wouldn't take immediate action on the recommendations, but reversed course following public criticism. Another senior Republican lawmaker has come under criminal investigation in a widening congressional corruption probe. The Wall Street Journal reports federal investigators are looking into whether Alaska Congressmember Don Young accepted bribes from the oil field firm Vico Corporation. Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, the former chair of the Appropriations Committee, is also under investigation. A new congressional report has found thousands of federal workers and responders are still lacking adequate health care programs to deal with the medical problems they developed at Ground Zero following the 9/11 attacks. The Government Accountability Office also says federal agencies may have greatly underestimated the cost of providing workers medical care. And two Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange, who traveled to the United States last month, have died. Nguyen Van Quy and Nguyen Vi Thong were members of a delegation that came for a lawsuit against over three dozen chemical companies that manufactured the toxin. American warplanes dumped about 18 million gallons of Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. The Vietnamese government says more than 3 million people have been disabled. But the U.S. maintains there's no scientifically proven link between the wartime spraying and the disabilities. Speaking outside a New York courtroom in June, Nguyen Van Quy said he suffered from cancer and two of his children had birth defects.
I am here as living evidence to tell the people in court that dioxin really has a negative impact on human beings as well as the environment.
Van Quy died earlier this month, just 9 days after returning to Vietnam. He was 52 years old. The other victim, Nguyen Thi Hong, visited our firehouse studio and also described how Agent Orange affected her life. She was exposed to Agent Orange in 1964. She gave birth prematurely to three underweight children, one of whom had a congenital heart defect. She had several bone and skin diseases, had her spleen removed, and was treated with chemotherapy.
In 2000, we got the results of the test. And they confirmed and concluded that I am affected with dioxin.
In
2002, and I had breast cancer.
Được các bác sĩ cắt và phẫu thuật.
And I had a surgery and the breast was removed.
Quá trình ghi xét điều tra điều trị quá trình điều trị thì các bác sĩ bảo là tôi bị di căn vào xương.
Well, as a result of the findings, the doctor mentioned to me that I was suffering from cancer and it is the terminal period and I'm suffering from the aftermath of cancer and it's now going to my bones.
Nguyen Thi Hong, speaking on Democracy Now! Last month. She died last week at the age of 60. In a statement, Merle Ratner of Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign said, quote, Nguyen Thi Hong dedicated the last weeks of her life to achieving justice for all Agent Orange victims. Despite knowing how serious her illnesses were, she had great optimism and hope. She will dwell forever in our hearts. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Red alert. Our national security is being outsourced. The most intriguing secrets of the war on terror have nothing to do with Al-Qaeda and its fellow travelers. They're about the mammoth private spying industry that all but runs U.S. intelligence operations today. The private spy industry has succeeded where no foreign government has. It has penetrated the CIA and is running the show. Those are the opening lines to a recent article in the Washington Post by R.J. Hillhouse, a blogger and novelist who closely tracks the privatization of the nation's intelligence agencies. According to Hillhouse, more than 50% of the National Clandestine Service has been outsourced to private firms such as Abraxas, Booz Allen Hamilton, Lockheed Martin, and Raytheon.
Hillhouse's article in the Washington Post created a firestorm of controversy within the intelligence community. A week later, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence responded, defending the use of private contractors. Now Hillhouse has exposed that the reach of these corporations is extended into the Oval Office. Private companies are now heavily involved in creating the analytical products that underlie the nation's most important and most sensitive national security document, the President's Daily Brief. And there appears to be few safeguards from preventing corporations from inserting items favorable to themselves or to their clients into the president's daily brief in order to influence the country's national security agenda. R.J. Hillhouse joins us now from Tulsa, Oklahoma. She's written extensively about outsourcing of the war on terror in her blog, thespywhobuildme.com. She's also just published a novel called Outsourced. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, R.J. Hillhouse. First, talk about this expose, what you found.
Well, what I found is, as you said, private corporations have completely penetrated the intelligence apparatus of the United States. It's impossible, even in the response to me by the Director of National Intelligence that was published in the Washington Post, they admitted that without private corporations, they would be unable to function. So what we're seeing is basic responsibilities of government have been handed over to the private sector, which I really don't have a problem with, but how it has occurred is very problematic. There are layers of responsibility that have been handed to private sector, so the government has actually very little control on some of what's going on in terms of espionage. There's management layers. I mean, private corporations actually run other corporations that are doing espionage work. The entire gamut of everything from the NSA, what is being done in pattern analysis with phone calls, internet traffic's handled by some private corporations, actual gathering of intelligence on the ground, running of covert operations on behalf of the CIA, it's all in private hands. Seems that James Bond bills by the hour.
And you talk even about the presidential daily briefing. Could you explain how that has become privatized also as well?
Well, it's not clear if the very final document is done by private corporations. It's clear at every stage of the way what's called a government employee or a blue badger will sign off on it. But all of the information that goes into it, the analytical products that become part of the president's daily brief, are produced by private corporations because the work of analysts who receive their paychecks from corporations such as Booz Allen, Raytheon and others is not distinguished from that of government employees. So that brings up a huge national security vulnerability that one could very easily shape or nudge along U.S. national security policy because this is the most important national security document that we have in this country.
Explain how the president's daily brief works. First, how that intelligence is gathered and then how it's presented to him.
The intelligence is gathered by the 16 different intelligence agencies by statute that make up the intelligence community. That would include more familiar CIA, the NSA, Defense Intelligence, some CIFA, various intelligence agencies, the National Counterterrorism Center. And each of those, the analysts, people gather the product of the intelligence. In some cases, things have been outsourced, like in the CIA, the actual case officers are outsourced, gather that intelligence. It goes to analysts. In the case of the CIA, the Directorate of Intelligence, acquaintances tell me that over half is run by private corporations or staff, the workforce is staffed by private corporations, with really analytical supervisors signing off on it. So they all gather the intelligence in the field, which much of that is gathered by private corporations, in these 16 different intelligence agencies, it's put into analytical products that talk about what the major topics or issues are in the different regions. It's funneled up to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which sifts through this and determines which are the most important pressing issues. And those are taken and put into the president's daily brief, which the Director of National Intelligence briefs the president on each day. I mean, we're all, I think, familiar with the president's daily brief, if nothing else, from that famous, I believe it was August 6th, daily brief from 2001, Bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S. It's meant to be able to give a heads up to the president and the very top of government officials as to what the potential problem, national security problems are that have to pay attention to that very day. And it's quite chilling when one realizes that because there is no distinction between the work of private corporations or the work of corporations, some of these are publicly traded, but I say private to differentiate from the public sector, the work of corporations and the work of government employees. And so there is great potential to introduce things into the intelligence stream or simply to nudge things in a certain direction. I mean, there would also be the possibility of political manipulation.
Now, given the possibility, obviously, that there are accountability issues and ethics issues involved by so much privatization of intelligence work, there would also seem to me to be intelligence issues, questions involved, security issues in terms of how are these people vetted, and also, at least within the agencies, like the Central Intelligence, they have career employees who they can follow throughout decades sometimes in terms of their reliability. But how are these private contractors vetted?
That's an excellent point. At this stage of the game, it's not as frightening as what will happen over the next 5 and 10 years. The people are vetted in the same way through the security backgrounds on polygraphs, et cetera, as a government employee is. In this case, most of them are former government employees that have gone over to the private sector. But the real danger occurs when, and those people have been socialized and trained, have been held in government yoke for 20, 30 years. So it's very unlikely that they would behave against the interests of the U.S. government. But then, of course, there's this next generation of spies. Like, what's going to happen as corporations begin to raise their own case officers, train them in corporate values rather than the values of public service? And at the same time, we've got hemorrhaging going on at the CIA, where over half of the employees of the CIA have been there for 5 years or less. So we have a situation where it's really kids running the CIA. So we have a great deal of instability in the system. And as turnover occurs, as companies lose contracts, of course, people become unemployed. And that also is a great counterintelligence danger with what happens to down-on-their-luck spies.
R.G. Hillhouse, Ronald Sanders, Associate Director of National Intelligence, Office of the Director of National Intelligence, wrote a letter of objection to The Washington Post about your July 8th Outlook article, Private Spies, Who Runs the CIA, Outsiders for Hire. He says it was way off base. It suggested the use of contract personnel by intelligence agencies like the CIA is somehow damaging to national security. He writes, quite the contrary. We could not accomplish our intelligence missions without them. U.S. intelligence agencies were dramatically downsized in the 1990s, in some cases by as much as 40%. Whatever else their pre-September 11th failings, our agencies simply don't have people, enough people, to do the job. Your response, RJ?
Well, first, I would agree with him on most of that, because that was not the point that I made. That the use of private contractors isn't the problem. The problem is how it's been structured. It's come about very quickly and in a wartime situation. So it's been cobbled together, and it's a very fragile system, and that's what I point to. I think many of these private companies are actually doing very good work. But what we need to see is that it's done in a smarter way, where it's a more accountable way. And we need to look at everything that these corporations are doing and see, should that be a government employee or should this be a corporation? Because what we're looking at is entire branches of the CIA are farmed out to private corporations. So you'll see 20 what they're called green badgers, or workers for a private corporation, reporting to a single blue badge or a government employee. And within the layers of green, there could be other companies that are reporting or part of that branch. So it's multiple corporations reporting back to a single government employee who most likely is a very junior person because of the high level of turnover at the CIA. So clearly that one blue badger or employee is not going to know everything that's going on. So there's some real accountability issues and questions about this, not just the scope, but the use of contractors. I mean, I completely agree that they couldn't do it without the contractors.
And how does weapons of mass destruction fit into this, the lie that was spread? Do you see that as part of this picture, or the result of this outsourcing?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a result of the outsourcing. Where I would fit WMDs in is simply an great example of the manipulation of intelligence that can occur when there's a political will to do so. And in this case, there was a formidable bureaucracy to prevent the manipulation of intelligence. I mean, much had to be put in place in order to use the bad intelligence from curveball to stovepipe everything up to the office of the vice president, and to really do a workaround from the bureaucracy of the CIA that was trying in many parts of it to prevent manipulation of the intelligence. But now what we see is, theoretically, it would be a lot easier to do something like the specter of weapons of mass destruction in another country, because corporations control the intelligence. They control the gathering of it. They control the intelligence in multiple different agencies. So suddenly you could have something being reported in the CIA the same time the NSA is picking up on it, and perhaps a military intelligence agency could be picking up. But with their current system, there would be no way to detect that it could actually be the same company that's behind it, that's feeding things into the intelligence stream. So that's how I would tie weapons of mass destruction into it.
R.J. Hillhouse, we're going to come back to you, but we're going to break first. R.J. Hillhouse writes a national security blog, thespywhobuildme.com. I want to ask about that PowerPoint presentation you got a hold of from the Office of National Intelligence, and also ask about your book, Outsourced, a novel. Stay with us.
Century, and we are armed to the teeth. We're all working together now to make our lives mercifully brief. And school kids keep trying to teach us what guns are all about. Confuse liberty with weaponry and watch your kids act it out. And every year now, like Christmas, some boy gets the milk-fed suburban blues.
To the teeth, Ani DiFranco here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking to R.J. Hillhouse, runs the blog thespywhobuildme.com. Latest article, Outsourcing Intelligence, is posted on the Nation magazine website. Juan?
Yes, I'd like to ask you about your novel. In addition to all of the research that you do on intelligence, you've now produced this fictional account, Outsourced. Why fiction?
Because I found that there were things that could only be written about in fiction. It's amazing for someone who has lived in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe to find that in this country we're in a similar place. In the repressive regimes, literature has often played the role of bringing things to light that could not otherwise be discussed. And I found that there are some things that are going on in the intelligence community, or things that are going on with our government, with the relationships between corporate and government, that it was only safe to discuss under the guise of fiction. So It's an unusual transformation that a novelist would actually be ahead of the media in this. I mean, it is the norm for me to be contacted each week by people from New York Times, Washington Post, and others to try to learn about what's going on in outsourcing. So it's very strange as a novelist that I actually have moved ahead of that. And I've not only been at the center of controversy in the intelligence community, I've also been in the center of controversy in the literary world. Because I believe that, and I've been very public about it, that thriller writers, that novelists have failed us today. They haven't helped us understand the darker truths of what's going on in the war on terror, the ambiguities, the changes that have occurred in how we're fighting the war on terror and what that shows us about ourselves. Unfortunately, thriller writers have failed us. As you know, it's mainly, and I'll call it for what it is, beach reads that we see, that we don't see literature playing this larger role in society, but rather the novels become a race of we have to stop the terrorist from what would be, in the jargon, A, B, or C weapons, atomic, biological, or nuclear weapons. And it underscores the narrative of our time, which is be afraid. Be very afraid, and only a hero who will violate the Geneva Conventions, only a hero who will violate the Constitution, will save us.
So R.J. Hillhouse,
I tried to
You focus on Iraq and Uzbekistan in this novel, and
yeah.
Also in this novel, you say Osama bin Laden has been captured, but they're just afraid to announce it for fear of terror attacks. Talk more about the core of the story, this fictional account.
I believe that core of the story is left in outsourced and in discussing it in the fictional account. I mean, I also deal with some other very hot issues that are best discussed only in fiction, such as the black sites run by the CIA, the secret prisons. In outsourced, those black sites have been privatized to private corporations. Private corporations are running the facilities management contracts. Private corporations are running the facility security contract. So various things like that can only be discussed in fiction until the mainstream media gets its act together.
Back on the story that you've been breaking news with in the Washington Post and at The Nation, you recently obtained an Office of the Director of National Intelligence PowerPoint presentation that reveals that 70% of the U.S. intelligence budget is allocated to private contractors. 70%.
It's an absolutely stunning figure. It was actually the journalist Tim Shorrock that first found that PowerPoint presentation and the slide that showed the 70%. My contribution to it was recognizing that because based of the information in it and in a hinted table in the presentation, it was possible to reverse engineer the national intelligence budget, which appears that we're really spending about $60 billion on intelligence each year, and out of that, $42 billion is going to private corporations. So what we see happening is the mainstream media has not been writing about this, has not been exploring it, but we've had a $42 billion industry come take over major responsibilities of government when no one was noticing, except a novelist who, as I said, is quite a turn of events.
And from what you've been able to tell, the impact of all of the intelligence failures around 9/11 and weapons of mass destruction and the reorganization of the nation's intelligence agencies, what's been the result of that?
Well, many of the changes have occurred in the intelligence agency. I'm not sure that we could relate those directly to what's occurred with outsourcing. And, of course, the manipulation of intelligence, that had nothing to do with private corporations, although, as I've pointed out, it would be possible to do that quite easily or much more easily now than before. But what we've seen is the CIA and other parts of the national intelligence community failed us when it came to 9/11. And unfortunately, because of changes that have gone on in the last 5 years, those agencies are much, much weaker than they've ever been before. I mean, I would even question whether the CIA will survive another year's. And if it does survive on the current trajectory, is it a CIA that we want to have? Currently, very high turnover rate. They're in great denial with what's going on. There have been some measures to try to stop it, but they're half measures at best. Over 50% of the people working there with less than 5 years experience, and this is a profession that it takes a, there is a great long learning curve. And within those, the people that are 50% or less, 5 years experience, there's high turnover among those as well. And at the same time, you've got another half of the agency is outsourced to private corporations. So there's some real questions of health of our intelligence apparatus, and it has definitely declined since 9/11. And those are some of the things that I look at in fictionally in outsourced.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. I want to thank Nasreen for being with us. Nasreen, the teacher who will be joining us, but I want to thank R.J. Hillhouse, who has written the new book called Outsourced, a novel, and is breaking stories on that issue, among them Outsourcing Intelligence, posted on the Nation magazine website. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Insecurity continues to escalate in the oil-rich Niger Delta. Dozens have been killed in the southern Nigerian city of Port Harcourt since the elections in April. On Wednesday morning, unidentified gunmen stormed the office of an independent weekly newspaper, The National Point. The paper's published by activist journalists and had recently reported on alleged links between local politicians and criminal gangs. Professor Michael Watts from the University of California in Berkeley, who's conducting research on oil politics and violence in the Niger Delta, was among the wounded. He was attending a ceremony honoring the award-winning Nigerian journalist Abiba Dompedro. Abiba was an eyewitness to the attack on Michael Watts and the National Point office. Abiba Dompedro joins us on the phone from Port Harcourt, Nigeria. Welcome to Democracy Now! Abiba, can you hear us? Abiba Dompedro.
Hello. Okay.
It's good to hear you. We do hear you now. Are you speaking to us from Port Harcourt?
Yes, I am. I'm right here at my desk in the office.
Can you tell us what happened to Professor Watt? What happened in the newspaper office?
Yesterday at about 11 a.m., Professor Michael Watts, who is a friend of mine, a friend of the newspaper, and I guess a friend of so many activists, journalists, and so on in the Niger Delta in particular, who's visiting Nigeria, visiting the Niger Delta once again. I mean, he comes like every year, nearly every year, to carry out investigations on the situation in Niger Delta. And yesterday was one of those visits. He had been here earlier on Sunday, and we spoke extensively about the situation in River State, in Port Harcourt, and the Niger Delta in general. And yesterday I was actually supposed to take him to Kayama, which is a Manishan community in Delta State, where the Ijaw Revolution, you know, it's a 12-day revolution, if you know anything about what's been happening in this part of the world, you know, took off with Isaac Boru and all that. We were supposed to go and see, you know, somebody, the second in command, Captain Owonaro. And then we were here with him, and then we also sort of, you know, interviewing him for get his perspective on what's happening on the worsening situation in the Delta. And then about a few minutes into his coming in, into our conversation, we heard gunshots and everything. Because this has become like a regular occurrence in this part of the world, of this part of the country. It was like, okay, one of those things, another shooting incident again. But the shots got loud, and it was clear soon enough that the shots were actually in front of our office in a D-line in Port Harcourt. And then I ran out of my office. My deputy, my deputy on the paper, ran out to the office overlooking the gate. And we saw some young men on motorbikes, you know, they had black T-shirts and so on, most of them anyway. And then before we knew what was happening, they were inside the building and all, they were shooting. The next thing we heard was they were asking, where's the white man, where's the white man, where's the money, and all that. They were all over the place, they were shooting. They shot our security guard on the heel, on the leg. And then they came up, and we couldn't run back into my office where Professor Watts was. And we were out there praying, and then the next thing we heard was that we're going to kill you, we're going to kill you, where's the money and all that. And I was even telling Constantine, maybe we should go out. And because I thought it was a hostage situation, they were going to take him away, probably kill him, because these things can happen. Nobody has been killed, you know, that way yet, but, I mean, it's that kind of situation. And that was it, and then they shot him, or, you know, they were going to shoot his leg, and I think he moved his hand or something, and they shot his one of his fingers. They hit him on the head with a pistol and all of that, and in fact, they had shot most of the doors in the office, and so that's where we have all, yeah, then after that, we took him, instead of us came in, and then we took him to a private hospital where he was treated, then we took our security guard to a public hospital, and that's where we are.
And how is the professor right now?
He's okay. I saw him like about 30 minutes ago. I actually spoke, got him to speak to us about the incident for our people.
Well, Abiba Don Pedro, I want to thank you for joining us. Award-winning Nigerian journalist has published a collection of her own reports on the Niger Delta called Out of a Bleak Landscape and Oil in the Water, Crude Power and Militancy in the Niger Delta. As we move now back to national politics in the United States, Alberto Gonzalez, Juan.
Yes, well, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is facing a possible perjury investigation over his sworn testimony on the Bush administration's domestic spy program. On Wednesday, Senate Judiciary Chair Patrick Leahy said he may request a probe over Gonzalez's insistence that a March 2004 meeting with congressional leaders was not called to address the warrantless spying. Several lawmakers in attendance have denied Gonzalez's account. And newly released documents show then-Director of National Intelligence John Negroponte later described the meeting as, quote, a briefing on the terrorist surveillance program, the same name administration officials used to describe the warrantless spying. Leahy says he will give Gonzalez until next week to revise his testimony.
Gonzalez's latest public claims came during a testy Senate Judiciary Committee hearing Tuesday on misconduct at the Department of Justice. Angry senators accused the attorney general of providing deliberately misleading testimony about warrantless surveillance, the politically motivated firing of U.S. attorneys, and the Bush administration's use of torture. We'll watch some of those excerpts now. This is Illinois Democratic Senator Richard Durbin questioning the attorney general on torture.
I think that this administration and your tenure as attorney general will be haunted in history by another issue, and that's the issue of torture. It is the reason I couldn't vote for your confirmation, the role that you played as counsel to the president in saying that we as a nation did not have to follow the torture statute and the provisions of the Geneva Conventions. Now, last Friday, President Bush signed an executive order interpreting Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions for the purposes of CIA secret detention and interrogation techniques. The executive order rejected your earlier position and acknowledges that the CIA must follow applicable law, including Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, the torture statute, and the McCain Torture Amendment, which I was happy to co-sponsor. Do you now agree that Common Article 3 applies to all detainees held by the United States?
What I can say is that certainly Common Article 3 applies to all detainees held by the United States in our conflict with Al-Qaeda. Conflict with Al-Qaeda, yes.
Well, I'm worried about the qualification at the end. Are you suggesting that other terrorist conflicts are not covered by Common Article 3 in terms of the treatment of detainees?
We have to look at the words of Common Article 3. The Supreme Court rendered a decision about the application of Common Article 3 with respect to our conflict with Al-Qaeda only. And so I believe, if I recall correctly, if that were the case, if there were a different kind of conflict that on its face isn't covered by Common Article 3, then obviously we would not be legally bound by Common Article 3, although I think the president has said we're going to treat people humanely nonetheless.
So let me get into a specific here. Last year, the highest-ranking attorneys in each of the four military services, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, the Judge Advocates General, testified before this committee, and I sent them follow-up questions asking their opinion about specific abusive interrogation techniques that this administration has reportedly authorized.
Senator Durbin questioning the Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by two teachers, one from Baghdad and one from Brooklyn, New York. They have been corresponding by email along with their students for years. Now the Iraqi teacher has come to the United States for the first time. We'll talk about her experiences with her kids in Iraq. Stay with us. Amr Taufik, soundtrack of the film about Baghdad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish in headline and audio form for any radio station to take. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan.
Well, 3 years ago, a Brooklyn school teacher created a project to connect his students with Iraqi youth. The objective of one-to-one Iraq contact was to teach students about the people on the other side of the war and to create a peace bridge between the two sides. The American and Iraqi students and teachers began exchanging emails about their lives, war, and growing up in Brooklyn and Baghdad. In Brooklyn, the project was led by Bruce Wallace. At the time, he was a high school teacher. He is also a member of the September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. His nephew, Mitchell Wallace, was killed at the World Trade Center on September 11th.
Bruce's Iraqi counterpart was a teacher of romance literature at a middle school in Baghdad for young women. Her name is Nesreen. For years, Bruce and Nesreen, as well as their students, have corresponded by email. Today, Bruce Wallace and Nesreen join us together in the Firehouse studio. Nesreen recently arrived in New York on her first trip to the United States. For security reasons, she asked that we do not use her last name. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Yeah. Nesreen, let's begin with you. Talk about the situation in Baghdad, what it's like for you to teach, for your kids to go to school.
Well, everything is difficult in Baghdad. Me as a teacher, when I go to school, it is hard to get to my school simply because the American troops are there in the streets and they sometimes close all the streets or sometimes they are stuck or stopped in the streets to, you know, it's a kind of a delay there will be for going to school. And looking for landmines or trying to attack some people, some Iraqi people looking for insurgents. And on my way to school, I saw many, many bad things, such as dead bodies, or sometimes the random shooting all of a sudden started. And when I go to school, sometimes I found students, and sometimes very few students, and sometimes no students.
In terms of the images that we see here, obviously in the United States when they are presented, are of constant the bombings that occur on an almost daily basis. On a day-to-day level for your students, what is life like? Does that violence, is it there constantly, or is it once in a while?
Constantly. Yeah. Because, you know, the situation is very, very difficult to be there in the school. Some of my students stopped coming to school because their parents were threatened or our family is threatened. Some of them afraid to come to school because of the bad situation in the streets, or afraid of kidnapping, things like that.
Have you seen U.S. soldiers in the school?
Yes, of course, many times.
Yeah, what happens?
We were visited by them many times. And they talked to the students, and there was, I remember that soldier, he behaved very badly, and he did many sexual gestures to my students. And they were very angry because, you know, they have their own ideas about how good people are the Americans. But when they saw that soldier, they were surprised. He was doing very bad gestures.
How old are your kids, the kids in the school?
I'm a teacher in a high school for girls. They are between 15 to 20.
Have any of your students died as a result of the violence?
Yes, many students. And many of them were kidnapped. And one of my one-to-one contact students was kidnapped.
One-to-one meaning the program
the program.
Emailing students here in the United States?
Yeah, she was kidnapped. Until now, nobody knows anything about her.
And Bruce Wallace, I'd like to ask how this all came about. And when did it start, and how did it develop? Did you reach out to Nazreen, or talk to us about the beginning of the project?
Sure. After 9/11 and Mitchell's dying,
tell us who Mitchell was.
Mitch Wallace was a Supreme Court officer. He was heading for work when the first plane hit, and he saw this. He had been trained as an EMT before that, and he ran to help. He was assigned to a fire company and given the task of going down into the lower levels and pulling victims out to ambulances and medical services. And at some point, he went in, and the tower collapsed on him, the South Tower.
Mitch was your nephew?
Yes, my brother's son. And after that, I was filled with anger and sadness and confusion. And it was months later that I found this organization, September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, a group of people all having lost family members and all having made the decision to turn this energy of grief and anger into works for peace. And I saw that each person had a project that they were working on. They were lobbying Congress, or they were talking and speaking out against the war. And I didn't have a project. But there was a peace fair in my high school in Brooklyn, John Dewey High School. And I decided to do a workshop about civilian casualties of political violence. And the workshop was very emotional, and the students were very upset by what I had to say. There were tears in the classroom. And at the end of the workshop, I said, well, okay, you have all of this energy. What will you do with it? What will you do to make the world a little more peaceful? And the students and I decided that the thing to do would be to communicate with people on the other side. just to get to know them and to let them understand that we did not hate them. And so I began, of course, I made the promise to the students that I would find these students to write to, and had no idea how I would do this. I just sent an email to every single person I knew, telling them what I wanted to do. A high school friend told me she knew someone who worked for an Arab American newspaper in the Midwest, and I contacted that woman, who told me she knew someone in Washington, D.C., who had some contact with Iraq and education, and I contacted that guy, who told me he knew someone who was a psychologist working with children and trauma, who was on the ground in Baghdad. And I emailed her, and she had already left. She was in London. But she said, don't worry, I have the email address of a cab driver in Baghdad who knows everyone. And I emailed the cab driver, who put me in touch with a woman who said, oh, my sister is a teacher. And that's how I met Nesreen. A few degrees of separation.
And Nesreen, when you were contacted by Bruce, I assume it was by email.
Yeah.
What did you then do?
Well, I first of all, I asked about his feeling, about his real purpose in this contact. And I was very, very glad to contact with him. It's a good opportunity, you know, to hear the people's voice through Bruce. Because I know that I saw many protests, many demonstrations against war. And this is something good, you know. And Bruce was one of them. When he told me his story about Mitch, it, you know, some kind of the same feeling, the same suffering. So I was so glad to be in such contact.
And what have your students gotten from the interchange, the exchange of views with his students?
Well, first of all, when I talked to them, they were so happy. They were well prepared to be in such contact. But, you know, the situation is hard there. So most of them say, yes, we agree about that, but without names, because we are afraid. They're afraid. They want to protect their families, their brothers, their sisters. But they were happy. So we start with phony names. Then a group of them said, no, we want to use our names. It is okay, because they are relieved when they talk to some of those students.
Yeah. And what do they write? These are girls in high school.
Yeah.
What are they writing to the kids?
Well, first of all, they talk about music. Better Boys, Blackstreet Boys, and something like that. Then I talked to them that this is not our issue, that we have many, many daily problems. Talk about that. And they started to talk about that.
Bruce, I wanted to ask you, as recently as this week, President Bush is making this connection between 9/11 and Iraq. You lost your nephew, Mitch, on 9/11. Just listen for a moment to this clip of President Bush.
Some say that Iraq is not part of the broader war on terror. They complain when I say that the Al-Qaeda terrorists we face in Iraq are part of the same enemy that attacked us on September the 11th, 2001. They claim that the organization called Al-Qaeda in Iraq is an Iraqi phenomenon, that it's independent of Osama bin Laden.
That's President Bush. Your response, Bruce?
It sickens me to hear these words. President Bush has been lying to the American people since before the war. He made a connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein before the war. Many of us knew at that time that Saddam was very much strongly opposed to an organization like Al-Qaeda, a religious-based organization. And these lies have continued and continued. And except for a few news outlets like yours, the lies get propagated in our public media. And for me, there's a sadness in that the American people accept this without investigation, without thought.
How about your kids in the Brooklyn school? We asked Nasreen about her girls. Yeah. What about the effect of this email exchange with your kids? How old are they?
They're high school students in Brooklyn, so they are between 12 and 18 years old. For them, it was partly an awakening of knowledge, and for myself also. I have a few college degrees. I went up to the master's level. I knew nothing about Iraq. I had to look for it on the map. I knew nothing about the culture, nothing about the people. For me, it was an awakening, and for my students also. I remember one email that said, "Oh, you hear Jay-Z in Baghdad? We just had no idea of who these people were." And little by little, learned to understand them as people very much like ourselves. And that was a very powerful thing for the students.
And Nasreen, you're spending 2 months now or some time here in the United States. Your impressions, having come from Baghdad now and coming here to the United States, your reaction to this country?
Well, I'm spending a wonderful time here. But, you know, sometimes people talking to me and my mind goes back to Iraq. And this is embarrassing. I can't forget. I can't. The shooting, the bombing, still there in my mind. And though I am very happy to be here with such wonderful people that I met.
Bruce, you went to Amman to try to get Nasreen out to be able to come here?
Yeah, the struggle to get Nasreen here started some 16 months ago. The application for a visa. September 11th, Families for Peaceful Tomorrows had an international conference last September 11th. And we invited 32 people from 20 nations in organizations very much like Peaceful Tomorrows. Civilians who had lost people in political violence who had decided to put this energy to peaceful work. And everyone got here except the people we invited from Iraq. Nasreen went to Jordan before September. They told her her visa was ready. When she got there, they said, "Oh, it will be ready tomorrow, and then next week, and then next week," and then she ran out of money and went back to Baghdad. This was repeated in January, where they told her the visa was ready, and I went. When she said she was going back to Baghdad, I said, "Wait. Wait 1 week." And I traveled there to meet her.
And so you have come. And you came on 7/7/07, yes. July 7th, 07. Yes. What is the subversive view you want to share with the American people in this last 30 seconds that seemed to be perhaps why this visa was so difficult to get? Well, I said it. What I mean is, what message do you have for the American people?
You know, it hurts when I heard that this war is a lie. Because I heard many people saying the same, that this war was illegal. And I know it's illegal. But saying it's a lie, it's something very, very... leave something inside me, hurt me very, very much. Because, you know, there are people dying there. Children, women are suffering. Men imprisoned in their houses, and it because of a lie.
We will leave it there. I thank you so much for being with us, Nasreen and Bruce Wallace, both teachers from Brooklyn to Baghdad. Their website is 121contact.typepad.com. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.